welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who managed to frustrate a 400-year-old prince-type guy when John couldn't stop eating all the eels that the prince was plunging into his stomach. It's John Levingood.
It was basically like the buffet in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom when they slice open that anaconda and all those river eels come out. It's like a buffet. I just get in the zone.
You were laying in basically like this weird chamber with only your head sticking out, a tube all the way in your mouth, and just eels one after the other.
Honestly, whatever it takes to consume the most eels before getting full, I'm willing to take the challenge.
You frustrated a very old person.
I mean, they say respect your elders, but I the only policy that I can offer is cleaning my plate.
When it ran out of eels, what happened?
I probably burped and took a nap. I mean, that dude had a lot of eels. I mean, I basically got intubated to eat all those.
Egads, man. Why? What are those movies where they try to torture somebody and the guy just doesn't really care about it and they're just really frustrated?
It sounds hilarious. I don't know what to call that though. but I mean, if someone's trying to torture me by getting me to eat a lot of meat, no worries.
It's like we're going to this Brazilian steakhouse. You're in a lot of trouble. You're like, oh no, you're in trouble.
Yeah, that's right.
Wait,
why
would they take you to a Brazilian meat place for torture?
I mean, anyone who's listened to the pod for a while or who just happens to maybe know me personally knows that, I'm a moderately large guy. I think that most people, though, don't eat like Tokyo demolishing monsters. And those people will go to a buffet and eat too much and regret it. But I have never had this experience. So it would backfire on them. But I mean, think about how when people have good food in front of them and it's all you can eat, they just goldfish themselves.
Yeah. I was just thinking about this in a Bond movie, right? Especially for maybe Daniel Craig in Casino Royale. If Mads Mikkelsen, the blood tear duct guy, I forget his name, took Bond to an all-you-can-eat buffet, Bond would hate it.
I suppose. I mean, he likes to look pretty lean, Daniel Craig Bond.
So is this a new form of torture?
Again, man, you give someone good food at an expensive price, but it's all you can eat. They're going to be like, I got to eat as much as I can. They're just going to tell themselves that because it's expensive. And they're like, I'm going to get my money's worth. And then they end up just gorging themselves. And they just leave that little thing that you flip over green all the time. So they just keep bringing you food. And it's like in Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5, where the girl dies by being fed to death by Freddy in her dreams because she was a compulsive eater.
Or the guy from Monty Python.
Right.
The wafer thin mint.
If I eat another bite, I'll burst. Just a wafer thin mint.
So if Le Chiffre would have just done that to Bond, they would have won.
I mean, Daniel Craig in that movie, in those movies, he looks like he hasn't seen a carb in a week. So, like, I think that his stomach is so small, like, he couldn't even eat a steak.
if it's not chicken breast.
I'm telling you, like, he'd bloat so easily, the poor guy. Like, he's probably hungry all the time, but then you give him food and he'll overeat so quickly because his stomach is all contracted. And then you punch him in the stomach once. I don't care how many muscles he has. How many? Everyone has the same number of muscles. I'm just like rambling. But it's like you punch him in the stomach then? That is it, dude. That is it.
They should just film James Bond eating slices of pizza and it would ruin all his mystique.
Like, I mean, I could picture Roger Moore Bond eating a few slices of pizza and late Connery Bond. Maybe even like Pierce Brosnan Bond if it's a day off.
I could see Dalton getting down at like a Wingstop. Drinking some Bud Light.
And Dalton's a sizable dude. He had probably the biggest natural frame of any of the Bond actors.
I could picture Pierce Brosnan brunching something serious.
He'd have like mimosa and avocado toast.
But a healthy amount, though. I could see him doing it. Like on the French Riviera, like where they serve 16 courses.
So it's like we're mixing Pierce Brosnan Bond with Pierce Brosnan from Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah. And he would get hit in the head by a lime.
Right.
It'd be a run by fruiting.
It was a run by fruiting. Oh, dear Lord.
I think, all right, Roger Moore was such a gentleman. Like, what's like something that he would hate eating that they could film and just ruin his mystique? What's a food that Roger Moore's Bond?
Baby back ribs. Right? You give that dude baby back ribs and he's wearing his white tux?
He's going to be sobbing by the end of it.
He's probably even if he tried to eat it with a knife and fork, I mean, that stuff just gets everywhere.
And if he tried to eat it with a knife and fork, he would just look silly.
Yeah, right. But he'd still get it on himself anyway somehow.
He would be crying by the end of it.
Especially if it's really good ribs, like falling off the bone ribs, like he get like when you push down with the fork, it doesn't like stab it like a firm piece of meat. It almost like breaks it up. So as he's lifting it to his mouth and it's like starting to fall apart, it falls like down his lapel.
Oh, he'd be in tears.
Oh, he'd be done. And he wouldn't see it. And then the Bond villain would be like at the other side of the table, like,
well, Mr. Bond.
It looks like the day is mine.
You're wearing your food well. So the James Bond villain wins just by looking Bond look silly. So
I mean, because he'd have to run home and get changed and he wouldn't be able to stop the death ray.
So if I'm a villain, I'm not going for world domination. I'm going to make the Bonds look silly via eating too much.
Dude, yeah. Yeah, give them chili, but make it with shredded chicken or shredded beef so it starts to fall off the spoon as you're eating it because it's clumpy, and then it splashes at their lapel.
I would put real tomatoes in there because they're kind of juicy.
Right.
I would make them eat chili with a fork. Dude, the way to get Daniel Craig's Bond is just to have him over for whiskey.
He's a petite but muscular and really lean fellow. He'll get drunk easily.
No, in Skyfall, he's Housen McCallan.
It's a good way to go.
And then I would just draw stuff on his face.
And while he's asleep.
Yep. My Bond villainy is just basically making the Bonds look silly.
So what you should do is you like put something on his face, but something that's easy for him to get off. But that way he can think that he got it all off. But the real thing is that like when he closes his eyes, it looks like eyes are open and he never knows that even when he's in front of the mirror. So like all the other people that he's fighting are just giggling because whenever he blinks, it looks like these weird eyes are looking back at you.
I would do a full back Sharpie tattoo on him.
He could be the Great Red Dragon.
I really like the Red Dragon in the third season of Hannibal.
Oh, I didn't see it.
Oh, it's really good.
I've never seen Hannibal.
Dude nails it. Yeah, it's a good show.
Yeah, so it's not like I chose, like, oh, like I don't like this show. I just never happened to get into it.
Speaking of food, there's a ton of eating in that show. And he's having very fancy dinner parties.
Feeding people?
Yeah. And it's like a cuisine, like they show him cooking everything, and then he places it down, and these people think they're eating, you know, duck from South America that was shoved into a shoebox for 6 months and only fed worms. You know, like they think they're eating something really decadent and rare, like a rhino that was buttered every day for 2 years.
Are you making this up, or are these lines from the movie?
No, I'm making
the
it.
The show, up. I mean. I'm okay. It was buttered every day for 2 years.
And it killed 14 people in the process. Rhinos don't like being buttered.
Nope. It softens their hard armor.
Eventually, they learn just to dump it on it with a barrel. But in the beginning, they had like rollers that you paint with.
If you put butter on a rhino and then it spends too much time in the sun, does it get like tan faster?
Yeah, it looks like Kramer in Seinfeld.
Oh, yeah. When Newman saw him and thought that he was like a turkey and wanted to eat him.
Yeah. I mean,
so many people right now who are in their 20s are listening to us like, what are you talking about? Look it up, Kramer, Turkey, Seinfeld. It's funny.
Or I can say for the young kids, iZombie, every episode she gets a brain and she cooks it really fancy, then eats it. So she,
oh, really?
Yeah. So
I've never seen that show either.
Oh, it's fun. Yeah, but every episode she like makes something fancy out of a brain.
it's like your zombie show that has like a Rachel Ray cooking segment.
It does. Because then she can eat it and get flashes, and then she can help the cops.
Oh, so she eats the brain. She gets to know the thoughts or memories.
Yeah, she's a medical examiner, and so she, like, if there's a murder, she'll have one of the brains, and then she's she works with the cops.
This is like an undead psychic cold case.
Exactly. I love it. It's by the guy who made Veronica Mars.
Which I also haven't. You're mentioning only shows that I haven't seen for a change. I haven't seen any of these shows.
Man, I'm hungry. And speaking of hungry, it's time for some listener questions.
Yeah, well, we got one to start us off, and it is... This is kind of deep, by the way, and it's thematic to the movie we're going to discuss today. So the Fear Merchant, that's at thefearmerchant.com, from at thefearmerchant on Twitter, asks, was there ever a time in your life where you questioned your own sanity, genuinely felt a break in your reality?
It was this week.
It was this week?
I went against all my better urges, and I watched Deep Blue Sea 2.
Oh, that's right. But you really kind of knew that was going to be awful.
Yeah, but I didn't know it was going to be that awful. Like
it was you didn't know it would like be upsettingly bad.
It's a dumpster fire of a movie. You know,
would it be a good bad movie Tuesday with a six pack and a bro?
No.
No.
It's horrible.
Like it failed to be amusingly bad.
Nothing is good about it. It is the most boring. They only do two lighting schemes, like blue. They just bomb everything with blue because they're like, oh, because the inside would be blue because water. And it's just no one. The plot is this idiot billionaire brings a bunch of other non-characters to his lab, and he's like, AI is going to take over. We need to make sharks smarter. So he gets these bull sharks, and they turn into a pack hunters, but then they don't go into the place themselves. They just make a bunch of babies, and then the babies swim around. You never see them. And then the babies eat people. And it's just a horrible, horrible – they walk around the same corridors. No one tries. The dialogue feels like it was – it doesn't – like I feel like vomit on a page takes work. It was more like – it was more just like drooled onto a page.
That doesn't sound very good at all.
I feel like someone started writing it, fell asleep. Their head fell on the computer, and that's what they went with.
So now that you've said though, now that you've made your case for how bad this movie is – do you think that now that I know this, I could enjoy this movie as a bad movie?
I hate it.
All right. Take that, Deep Blue Sea. We're not tagging you in this plug because you're not gonna like us.
You're a garbage pot. You know what, Deep Blue Sea? I wish I could feed you baby back ribs and make you look silly.
I wish I could feed Deep Blue Sea 2 to Deep Blue Sea.
It's it hurts my – I don't write many – angry reviews, but I wrote one for I call it a terrible movie in my review that like rips off its predecessor. Garbage pile. Like, you know, in those futuristic movies where those trash can fires, that's what this movie is.
for me, questioning my own sanity, this is interesting because this reminds me of when we were discussing Sea Beasts in an earlier podcast, and we brought up the mysterious giant octopus scene from the Goonies.
Yeah.
How like – and so there was a time – and not to use that specifically, but there was a time when, back when we just had VHS where a movie came out and there was only ever one version of that movie. It wasn't – you know, like director's cuts weren't common, and sometimes the VHS cut would be different than the DVD cut. And so when Mel Gibson's Payback came out, do you remember that movie?
Yeah, there's a couple different variations of it, isn't there?
Right. And so I bought the DVD of it, and it was like the director's cut. And I just thought it would have some extra scenes or something. And it was like a totally different movie. And so like I saw it in theaters back in the 90s when it came out. Then I bought it years later, and I'm watching it. And I'm like, I don't remember or any of this. Like, what's going on? Like, I was so confused because it wasn't just a couple scenes. It was like the whole last 30 or 40 minutes of it was a different plot. And then like a year or two more passes and I see it on HBO and it's what I remember it originally being. And now I'm not seeing any of the scenes that had me confused the last time. And so I didn't understand what was happening. And then years later, when I was on Amazon, I saw they were selling the two different versions. And in one of their reviews, one of the Amazon reviewers was explaining how the director's cut is a terrible movie, but the theatrical cut is an outstanding movie.
So you're just like, what am I watching? This isn't what I watched.
Right. It's like I seriously was thinking, like, did I even really watch this movie in the theaters, or did I fall asleep in the last half? Because when I saw it the second time when it was the director's cut, I did not necessarily remember what I wasn't seeing. I just knew I was seeing a lot of stuff that I'd never seen before. And so you're kind of bewildered as to what the hell is going on. And then again, when I saw it yet another time, and so that's the other thing. I kept yo-yoing myself. Like, I love this movie. Wait a minute. I hate this movie. Wait, I love this movie. And like, it was so weird. It was the most bewildering movie viewing experience summary that I've ever had. Like, just if you look at all the times I saw that movie, it's so just weird. And it really, no, but this isn't just like a funny thing. Like, I was like very bothered. I was really confused. And I'm like, how the hell I have not seen this. And then later I see the other thing again. And I don't know. But I mean, a Mel Gibson movie. My answer is a Mel Gibson movie. All my other stuff is a little too personal, probably, to share. The Fear Merchant, who has given us a lot of wonderful questions. I can tell you this in a private message, the other stuff. But this one, this is like, as far as movie related things goes, that just really, really got me.
Did I tell you about the time that my brother-in-law tried to watch the director's cut of Batman vs. Superman, and we accidentally put in the regular cut, and we watched the entire thing, and we thought, oh yeah, this is new.
Like, just some things that weren't too crisp in your mind from your original viewing.
Yep. And at the end of it, we're like, what, they add like 3 seconds? And then we realized we watched the wrong disc. That
would really bother me.
I questioned my life choices. I didn't question my sanity.
Right, because you chose to watch it again.
Oh, brother.
You saw the Martha, you thought that they added three, you thought that he said Martha one extra time during the Martha scene.
Yeah, and I thought that they showed the beads falling in slow motion from Bruce Wayne's mom when she got shot longer, you know. Stupid.
Oh, thank you, The Fear Merchant. Love your material on Twitter, and we'll have a few more listener questions later in the pod.
Speaking of insane, the movie that we're talking about this week is not insane. I love it.
I mean, I think that the movie is insane, but I also love it.
This is, so what we're talking about this week is A Cure for Wellness. It is a 2.5-hour gothic horror, hard R-rated $40 million movie that is essentially a dinosaur in today's day and age. It's directed by Gore Verbinski, the guy who did The Ring, Lone Ranger, all the Pirates movies. And I think it's one of the best-looking movies of recent years, and I think it's most certainly the best horror film I've watched in years. I mean, they developed a new aspect ratio, like 1.66 for it. You know, when you watch it, you nerds like me, you'll get it. They shot it in Germany, some beautiful castles. I mean, that, like, it's one of the best-looking horror films I've ever seen, but it's a true oddity, John. It made $8 million in the United States. Like, it tanked like a Sherman, but it's just a very weird, hard R-rated bonkers fest that we love.
Well, you know, and now I did not see this in theaters, and as best I recall, I don't remember what else was playing at the time, but I know that I decided not to see this in theaters. Like, I decided to, because I didn't know what the hell this movie was. And now that I've seen it, I saw it for the first time late last year. I saw it again in the last week, preparing for this. It's splendid. Do you want to tell everyone what it's about?
Yeah, I can do it.
You want to do this? Okay. I mean, this is a weird one.
Spoilers.
Okay. Yeah, spoilers across the board, all podcast.
All right. So, this is the true story of a guy named Lockhart, who he's like a young punk. He's working his way up in this, I don't know, big business. He gets blackmailed because he does some shifty business. And because he gets blackmailed, he has to go get some guy named Pembroke, who is up in Switzerland at a, like this place, like a cure, like where he's getting cured for, I don't know, whatever he has. So Lockhart goes to Switzerland. He gets stuck there. Accident happens. He gets his leg broken. He finds out that everything is not what it seems there. And it turns out that, geez Louise, that it is run by a guy named Vollmer, played by Jason Isaacs, who's around 300 to 400 years old.
Well, you don't know that until late in the movie.
And,
yeah.
And he has, so I'll save it. So it's about this young punk who goes to a Swiss cure-all place, and strange things happen.
So if this movie, if you just read like the IMDb thing, I think they say something like, you know, a young executive has to go to the Swiss Alps to retrieve a missing CEO from a wellness center, and things aren't what they seem. And like when you read that and when you see the original trailer, you're just like, what is this movie though? What am I going to watch? Like this movie has so many kind of phases to it. Like I've talked before about movies that really feel like several different short movies put together. Like this started out feeling like it was some kind of like mystery thriller. Then it kind of goes into this like medical or psychological horror. And then it kind of turns into some social thriller aspect. And then it comes to this absolutely not psychological, but still medical horror. And then it goes to this batshit crazy, what the crap town.
Yeah.
Like this thing covers so many bases. Like I felt so many things, like it has so many flavor and they all work well together, but it's like this thing has so many different flavors packed into one thing.
Some person was writing about this and they said it has the visceral logic of a bad dream. And I thought that was kind of fun. Like I think the movie made sense to me and there were a lot of questions. And I'll tell you what though, halfway through we stopped the movie and we just started research. I know that you're supposed to embrace everything, but we were so obsessed with the cinematography that we looked it up. And the guy's name was Bojan Bezelli, who shot The Ring, Lone Ranger, Rock of Ages, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Hairspray, a movie called California. And he talked about, we just wanted to know everything about that hospital they shot in, like Hitler was treated there after World War I. They spent months cleaning that place. Some of the sets burnt down. They use this like brand new Alexa open gate camera that can shoot side to side with prime lenses. They developed a new aspect ratio, 1.66:1, established more like more height than width. I mean, it's like the color palette, that train shot. So I guess a lot of people question, you know, what happened with this movie. I was just more in love with the technical aspects of it.
Can we return to the aspect ratio? You actually brought up a lot about that for interested listeners in our episode on The Ritual, and I had never really heard of this. Could you explain just briefly like what this aspect ratio did for this movie compared to like what is standard?
All right, so let's picture a 50-inch widescreen TV.
Mm-hmm.
The traditional blockbuster shoots in a 2.39:1 aspect ratio. So that means when you're looking at your TV, there's going to be some pretty big black bars that are buffering the top and bottom of the screen. So it's going to be a very wide shot. You're going to see a lot. That's why, you know, the widescreen aspect of it. So you're going to be able to see more on the left to right. But you're not going to see much, like, you know, in the vertical. Like, you're going to see more of the horizontal, not the vertical.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you look at what movie were we talking about? The Ritual. They shot that in 2:1. So that means there's more vertical than normal. It's more of like an actual TV box. There's less buffering on the top and bottom. You get more of the screen, but it's not as wide. So this movie, typically TV shoots in 1.85:1. So when you look at a TV show, it does have the kind of square boxiness of it. This goes even less to 1.66:1, which means there's a lot more vertical. More height than like width. So when you're watching this, you really get this crazy scale. You get the crispness of the Alexa from the prime lenses, and then you also get a lot of the vertical like shot. So there's less widescreen, but everything looks, you know, just bigger and taller and grander of what you're seeing.
It's interesting that you say that, because when I was jotting down notes for a review about this movie, I was basically thinking like how Gore Verbinski brought his almost grand, this grandeur sense of scale like that we see in the Pirates movie and the Lone Ranger. But I didn't really know what it was about it that made me feel that way. I just assumed it was the general approach of the cinematography and camera angles. But I don't really pay attention, obviously, to the amount of black that I see at the top and the bottom of my screen. So I guess, in fact, this was augmenting my experience of what was this grand cinematography.
This is a great example. Watch Jurassic Park. Watch a clip of Jurassic Park on your TV. That's 1.85 to 1. Then watch a clip of The Lost World. That's 2 to 1. Then watch a clip from Fallen Kingdom. That's 2.39 to 1. So if you go on YouTube and watch those three clips, and I don't know if you can cast it on your TV or do full screen, you will notice a change in aspect ratio. Now, when you watch Jurassic Park, imagine that even taller compared to that. So it's pretty cool, man. Like, this is a this cinematographer was like working for Gore, because he shot The Ring, this guy. He's like working – and The Lone Ranger, which is one of the most beautiful films I've seen in years. He's like, it's tough. you just have to be flexible. You have to develop new stuff. And so Gore, I think this is one of his best-looking movies he's ever made, but it's also a 2.5-hour gothic, hard R, bonkers fest about incest and eels.
You know what else is weird about this movie with all those genres is that I kept feeling like I was watching a period film, even though it took place in present day. But the remoteness wasn't just remote from technology or help. It felt remote in the sense that it was almost like this technology didn't exist. Not that you couldn't access it. Like everything, these approaches, and even the medical approaches that we see, the kinds of treatments that we see, they feel so 1800s.
Yeah. And so, well, you know, all these rich people come to this place led by Dr. Vollmer, and basically they don't have any friends because they've all been assholes and they've just pursued money. And so they go here for wellness. And when you get there, it feels like an 1800s or like even like a weird 1950s people in a pool, you know, doing weird stretches. I mean, you know, there's a cheeky line with Dane DeHaan. Oh, no cell service. They're like everyone's getting what? Hydrotherapy. That's the theme of this place. Drink lots of gross water and just get hosed down. It's weird. It's really weird.
You know, you're making it sound – it gets very dark. But when Dane DeHaan does first pull up, it seems almost like utopian, idyllic, serene, euphoric. Everyone's wearing these immaculate white robes while prancing around on this perfectly green lawn. They're playing badminton and croquet, and they're having, you know, sunny Tai Chi lessons. And everyone looks blissful and calm and generally on the older side, as it turns out as well. I guess these, you know, captains of industry or robber barons, I suppose. But still, like, it seems – it gives you that – it's that classic movie sense of, oh, things are perfect here. But no, they're too perfect for me to swallow.
And yeah, and when you first watch it, there's a lot of – like, everything's basically centered. So a lot of the shots that you see when he first pulls up in the limo – on both sides of him, the buildings are centered. When he's in the boardroom in the beginning, a beautiful centered conference room shot. There's also like a lot of rack focus, which comes into play later, which is something's in focus up front, then you rack to something behind it, and that's in focus, and the person up front isn't. And as you move towards the movie, everything starts idyllic and beautiful, because like, why would you want to leave? But when you as the movie moves on, people slowly become off-centered a little bit in the frame. Right.
And of course, and their behavior becomes less normal too.
I know I'm becoming a big dork with the filming, but it's something you start to notice. And I know I talked way a lot about it in Ritual and Happy Death Day, which is getting a sequel. But I don't know. I like how this world, like this movie, it starts off normal. Like something is off in the beginning. You feel something's off because it has that weird color palette and it looks like it's The Ring 3, just the way they shot it. And then the movie just gets turned to like 13 weirdness.
And, you know, and there was a bit of a harbinger of some of the weird, the weirdness of maybe the writing and or direction when Dane DeHaan is summoned to the boardroom of this like Wall Street, you know, corporate board of some company. They are behaving as inhumanly and emotionless and robotic, almost like the corporate boardroom in why can't I think? It's almost like in Mayhem, maybe. Like everyone's just like they're automatons.
Yeah.
You need to go and retrieve him. Clearly, he's lost his mind. Clearly, you know, it's like, but their faces are motionless. There are no brow raises. They're all speaking slowly. Their bodies are almost frozen, except for maybe clicking a pen. Like it was this. I was ready for someone to reveal that there were robots under their faces, and he was in Westworld. Like
they're just. It was just so calculated. You could tell they wanted to intimidate.
It was weird. And then he's just this slick guy. And I really liked the way that they showed how slick he was with his friends. And, you know, he's like this fast talking kind of yuppie goal getter. And on the train, when he's interacting with the guy asking for tickets and he's got his cell phone there, he's got his coffee. He's reaching for his ticket while he's on the laptop. And he says, business or pleasure? And he looks up like pressing the phone against his shoulders like, really, dude?
Yeah.
I was just giggling at like the Dane DeHaan-iness, this Wall Street meets Boiler Room, and then he's charged and blackmailed, I suppose, by the board in a way to go retrieve this clearly insane CEO who wrote this letter that gave this harrowing narration, this deep soliloquy of human greed and the inhumanity of our goals. And like that's setting such a weird tone. That tone doesn't seem to fit with the other acts of the movie, but as you go from chapter to chapter of the movie, it all seems to transition well nonetheless. It's beautifully done.
Yeah, it transitions well. And I was so happy to get out of all the typing because the guy in the beginning who died of a heart attack and then Dane DeHaan, they typed ridiculously loud. They were slamming on those keyboards.
No one likes a loud typer.
If I'd have been on the train with Dane DeHaan, I would have rear naked choked him. I'd have fed him barbecue ribs. And then he would have had to have washed his hands every 3 minutes so he wouldn't be typing.
So did you happen to think that maybe Dane DeHaan seemed perhaps as sinister and conniving as he could be charming?
Yeah, and I think what I liked about his character was he pulled off the charming and sinister, but he was also young and naive. Like he did some boneheaded moves that got him caught by the higher ups. So he's mm-hmm. a classic case of someone who's smart but not that smart yet.
Right.
But his motivations and his desire after what kind of happened to his parents, you see him he keeps a lot of people. Just became content. My voice is cracked. Content with what was happening to them at this place, but because of his drive and like sneakiness and like resiliency, he really wanted to move forward. So I think that's what kept him alive.
Mm-hmm. So when he's approaching, when he gets to the Sweden and he's got his driver and they're having their exchange and he's making his way through the village. And they're explaining the kind of this dichotomy between the villagers and those who live at the top of the hill. And you look up and you see like this castle. The first thing I think of is this is like Frankenstein.
Yeah. No, for sure.
And then later in the movie, we start to get snippets of the history of the Baron who started some kind of a health center. Well, no, he started trying to research a way to save his ill wife.
Yep.
But you start to learn more and more about the history of the wellness center and of the Baron and of the villagers and how it all pieces. And so just as we're going, it's not so like predicting the mystery at hand. It's just that you keep getting more puzzle pieces that enhance our mental resolution of what's going on. And I thought this was, and then he goes and there's no real technology where we're going. modern. It felt like the period piece. You could have told me if I started this movie like 40 minutes in, there are whole 20 minute segments where I'd just believe you if you told me it took place in 1908.
No, yeah, absolutely. And I think I like that aspect of it. There's a certain timelessness to it. And you know what's pretty interesting is we learn early on about the Baron. He was killing peasants to do experiments on him. Then he was mummifying them. And then the peasants found out, and then they just went and killed him.
Right, and he was doing it trying to research away with the euthanizing aspects of this otherwise toxic water coming out of the Swiss Alps. He was trying to research a way to preserve or heal or whatever his wife. And so, but he did it by kidnapping people and experimenting on them.
It's pretty interesting how he starts with peasants and then he moves on to billionaires.
Because it's so much easier when you have willing subjects.
Yeah.
and he, you know, and I said like how Dane DeHaan was so charming yet sometimes a little sinister in his means, you know, just his slickness, his attempts to intimidate or threaten. And then Jason Isaac's character, Vollmer, is very much the same. He is also very sinister and very charming. It's just that Dane DeHaan, as the movie progresses, loses more and more control, whereas Jason Isaacs stays calm and seems to perhaps gain more and more control in their power struggle.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the car accident happens. So Dane's like, he's going to go back into town because he realizes his initial thing, he can't get Pembroke out of there. And then a deer walks in front of the car. There's a big car accident. And then he finds himself back at the hospital with a broken leg, and Vollmer's taking care of him.
So we ultimately realize that him getting hit by that car and having any reason to be brought there for any manner of medical help is really the keystone that moves this story along. Like, what if he didn't hit that deer?
He'd have gone to town and drank a full beer.
And then he would have just come back and been a jerk again the next day. Like, I don't know how that movie would have gone on without it. And I sometimes found myself thinking after I first saw the movie that it was all on purpose, but it was really only on purpose after Vollmer was convenienced by Lockhart being in the car accident.
Yeah, that was fortuitous.
Right? But then Dane DeHaan wakes up with this broken leg. He's got this big cast on, and then it's suggested that he rests for a while, and then later he seems stressed. Maybe he should take a treatment, a few days of treatment, because Pembroke took a bad turn with his health at some point or so, he's told, and has a 2-day treatment or something. So he accepts some treatment and, oh, well, now I'm a patient.
And then he has to chug water.
And he has to, because everyone there is, remember, drink lots of water. You've undergone a great deal of stress.
It's not like your teeth won't fall out and you'll become dehydrated.
So there's a scene in the movie where someone is giving some kind of medical advice while saying over and over again that they're not a doctor. He's like someone who works at a slaughterhouse, basically. And except like when asking why people's teeth are falling out, he says, I guess my first inclination would be chronic dehydration. I'm like, I've never heard of this. Maybe this is really a thing. But it's like, your teeth are falling out from dehydration? Dane DeHaan was only in that facility for like a week.
And then his teeth were falling out.
And his teeth are whole teeth. They never even started to have any discoloration. And his gums look fine. He's just suddenly yanking out a tooth. Like, what the hell just happened?
And the words of Jerry Seinfeld, what's with all the water?
Why are our teeth falling out? So this movie kind of took this like, well, very, you know, fledgling screen time level, this boiler roomish Wall Street-y into this kind of corporate mystery. But then we kind of find ourselves entering more and more like this Shutter Island feeling. And I mean, this movie to me, by the way, like if I was to give my movie analogy tagline, this is The Road to Wellville meets Shutter Island with a dash of Frankenstein.
I like it.
So he's there and he's getting Shutter Island, right? He becomes a patient inadvertently, but he sees it happening. But then he becomes a wellness treatment a wellness patient and not just someone who is treated in the sense that they broke their leg. And then he starts questioning aspects of his own sanity when he starts seeing things. He starts having weird dreams. He starts having visions that they involve eels for some reason. He thinks he sees something in his water that's very reminiscent of Prometheus.
A little. Someone said that's a little tiny eel. Someone had a theory that they were giving them smaller and smaller eels to make them used to the things.
That is smaller than an eel and an unhatched egg.
Yeah,
so
I didn't believe it.
Not that movies tend to stick well by biology, but it's like maybe that's sort of what's being implied, or maybe it was just some other parasite. Maybe it was like some kind of blood parasite worm, or who knows. Maybe it was just something that's a symbiont, like a parasitic symbiont of eels in fresh water over there.
Maybe.
And it just happens to be there. Even the 1988 horror movie called Snails also involved blood flukes, which are these worms that get in the bloodstream of animals and create mean infections. But because blood flukes are often parasites, internal parasites of snails. And then when animals eat them, they end up with blood fluke infections that become advanced. And they dealt with that in this otherwise, bad, gory, campy horror movie, but like maybe this is kind of analogous to that. It's just in this movie that does involve a sort of physical invasion of one animal, there's some other animal involved too, and they're just acknowledging it with a mosquito larva, because that's what I'm pretty sure that's what that was, an actual like on-screen live mosquito larva.
Do you want to talk about the tank scene,
dude? Wait, do you mean the sensory deprivation tank,
yeah,
or do you mean the Pembroke tank?
Where they dunk him in the tank and then the nurse shows up.
So yeah, oh God. So, right? Go ahead, lead the way.
So he's starting his treatment. They put him in this massive tank, give him an oxygen hose, and he's supposed to hang out in this water.
In this sensory deprivation tank.
And so he's hanging out in there, and all these eels start coming through. And Dane DeHaan actually shot in there. It took like 5 days, maybe 10 days to shoot this scene. So we got like – he was just hanging out in water. But the weird thing is that the guy who's supposed to be keeping an eye on Dane gets distracted when this nurse comes up to him. She shows him her boobs, and then he starts,
Masturbating.
All the while Dane's like – almost dying because he freaks out because of eels. That's what kind of movie this is.
And then that nurse sticks around and is and that dude who just finished, for lack of a better word, open the tank, pull out a nearly drowned Dane DeHaan or Lockhart, and they're like even shining their flashlight and they're like, there are no eels in here. And then he looks and there's no eels in there. And now we're left to wonder, did he hallucinate this, or did this happen? And by the way, as a movie viewer questioning my own sanity, looking at you, the fear merchant, did I even see this masturbation scene? What just happened? This is so bonkers.
You know what I think, though? Later on, when we meet the eels attack all the dead bodies, so they didn't attack Dane DeHaan in this chamber. So I think he might have been seeing things.
And then we have to ask ourselves, how is he hallucinating something that does exist in the movie before he encounters it in the movie? Or is this just an artistic filmmaking device of Gore Verbinski's, because this is going to be a common theme in the movie?
Good question. Someone asked Gore that, and he's like, well, I just want people to interpret it how they see.
So someone actually asked Gore that exactly?
Yeah, and he's like, well, I want people to interpret it the way they want.
Okay. Yeah, but I mean, it was almost a little Event Horizon-y to me that he was hallucinating something potentially that really would be seen later.
This movie, though, like every 15 minutes you see things and you're like, am I seeing this?
Dude, I was thinking that. So we just brought up a masturbation scene. Just to be totally clear, and I'm not going to say when these things happen in the movie, but during this movie, we see elderly full frontal nudity of multiple people. We have so many storytelling aspects hearkening to incest. We have discussion of, storytelling aspects of, and in-scene depictions of deformed fetuses. We see this masturbation scene. We see this physical eel, live eel immersion into one's body. And we have an underage father-daughter rape scene. Now, when I say this list of things, if you were still listening to this podcast, despite the spoilers, having not seen the movie, I want you to know this movie did not feel exploitative to me, even though it has twice the number of elements that you need to potentially be considered as such.
Yeah.
This was a weird movie.
We haven't even – you know who we haven't talked about yet is Hannah.
And speaking of which, you brought this up. At some point, we see what is supposed to be a 13 or 15-year-old girl naked.
Yeah. And I was like, wait, what? And then she's 22.
The actress is.
Yeah,
she's
one of those like waifish. Is that that's not derogatory. She's a very
slight
like model, like 22. But when we saw when that scene happened, I went, huh? I was like, and then I immediately looked up her age because I felt a little weird.
But in the movie, there's a kind of sick coming of age aspect to it.
Yeah, and because Lockhart.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's actually 300 years old. She is.
So I was kind of going back and forth with that, actually.
300. She's the daughter. Remember that picture you found with
right?
So that girl has been slowly aging because of the fishy drops for 300 years.
Is that what that was? Because I thought that that girl then grew up, and then he had a child with that girl.
No, because for 300 years he's kept her there, and then
because it did look like her,
and then she finally stepped into water, and then that's when he kept her in all those years, and when he finally let her out, that's when she kind of had her awakening.
Okay, because it threw me off because there was the painting there, and I thought that the painting was her mother, but maybe the painting was her.
I think it was her mother, and then the daughter just looked a lot like the mother.
Okay, yeah, like that was – I was kind of dodgy on what that was. But I mean I'm convinced. And yeah, it's such a weird movie, though. It's such a weird movie.
This got a wide release, John. This was like – this had studio backing, $40 million. Like this movie happened.
And I'm glad if they don't remember. So I sound baffled by this movie when I bring up all the weirdness of it, but I love this movie. And when I'm describing all these crazy elements, but they worked. It all worked. And we haven't even gotten into the batshit aspects of it yet. But this movie, it did work. And so we know that Dane DeHaan is investigating, or Lockhart is investigating, right? He breaks his leg in this car accident. He gets Shutter Islanded. He's now a patient, and then he's a psychological patient almost, or a wellness patient. And then he starts seeing things, and then there's the eels, and he starts learning more and more about this sick history. And he sees in the photograph that Hannah's there with the man all covered up who was burned, who turns out to be the Baron, who's still alive now, even though that was hundreds of – well, that picture was actually just like
– 200 years, because it was like 1830 or something?
Yeah. And so and then Lockhart realizes that his leg wasn't broken. and so this brings me back to, what if he didn't get hit by the car, and we see he didn't have a broken leg?
Oh man.
And so but at that point, right, at the point that he didn't break his leg, why didn't they just put him in a full body cast?
Yeah, you're right.
They thought they could manipulate him like they manipulated everyone else. And Vollmer just thought, I want to make him yet another person who desires to be here so that I can milk him of his essence and make this extract, which makes me think of the Skekthes abducting little gnome people in the Dark Crystal to get those tears from them or whatever. But to harvest what Lockhart, when he takes Hannah out to the Frankenstein village.
Yeah.
And he tastes these vitamins. He actually said it tastes like sweaty seafood.
I have an issue with when he goes to the village.
Does it have to do with like the punks?
No, he orders two beers. He and Hannah sit down. He takes two
He gave sips. What he thought was a 13-year-old a beer.
Yeah. And then he takes two sips of it and then he walks away. He left a full, delicious beer on a table, unconsumed.
So I agree and disagree. I disagree in that I don't think that beer was delicious. I think it was just a beer. But at the same time, he had gone days without one.
Any beer is delicious.
Right. At that point, any beer is delicious.
I'm not a big fan of packaged Danish, but when I ran the Tough Mudder, a 12-mile run through obstacle courses, when they gave me a packaged, like, stock Danish, I ate that thing like it was the best food that I've ever had in my life. If I was in a mental hospital for days with a broken leg and I got to drink any kind of beer, I'd be like, this tastes good. So how about this, John? We got a lot more to talk about. We have a lot of questions. Let's take a break. Let's knock open a Creature Comforts beer.
I'm gonna have some eels in mine.
Yeah, we'll do
mosquito larvae.
We'll do a Tropicalia with eels and a cosmic debris with mosquito larvae, and we'll come back and we'll talk about the rest of this movie. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. That was a great beer, John.
I mean, Creature Comforts always is.
Creature Comforts follows us on Twitter.
I wouldn't mind if Creature Comforts sent us some beer, but right now I'll take the back padding.
We're legit Creature Comforts fan.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I actually first had Creature Comforts with you about a year ago when you first presented me with Tropicalia.
I have Tropicalia soap. Megan has an Otto the Brewery Cat pin. I have a Tropicalia shirt.
And I was a big fan of that. What was it? Coca Boonie?
Oh, yeah. That's very good.
That's super good, man.
The other day, I ordered a Tropicalia while wearing a Tropicalia shirt, and I felt silly.
You're like the dude who goes to see the band wearing – the dude who wears the band of the band that they're seeing.
I'm the guy at the Stones concert with the Stones shirt.
That's right.
That was delicious, though. It was a cure for wellness. It was a cure for badness. It was a cure for a bad day.
Yep.
If you have about 18 of them, that might be a cure for your wellness.
But, I imagine so.
All right, we got a bunch of. Do you want to talk about the movie more, or do we want to do the rest of the listener questions and allow that to kind of finish up the movie?
I want to see where the mania of these questions take us. We still have more to get to, but I think we're going to squeeze these eels out of these mummified, ever dehydrating bodies.
Oh, dude, I want to see Roger Moore in a nice suit attempting to grab eels out of a kiddie pool.
Oh, gosh, he's going to get eel slime.
I read his autobiography. I'm a huge Roger Moore fan, but I'd like to see his Bond do that.
I see him getting a little flustered. All right. First question. Twitter user at Cthulhu502 asks, did this movie need to be 2.5 hours long?
Did it need to be? No. Did it have to be? Yes.
So this is an interesting question because while I acknowledge that this movie is long, none of it is slow. And I was interested the whole time. And despite all the batshit bonkers tastic stuff that happens, none of it felt gratuitous, even though it felt weird. All of the plot seemed pertinent to me, and it always seemed to build towards something bigger. So I don't know if I want to see the shorter version of this. It might have had – so I mentioned earlier how there are all these different flavors and it feels like a whole bunch of different movies when you just hear all the components happening. If you had less time to stitch that together, you might not have as much richness to connect them.
I mean, there's just so many beautiful things to look at. I mean, aside from some of the – I mean, the movie looks beautiful. Even when they're drilling a hole through someone's tooth, you're like, that's a great shot.
Oh, God, that was tough.
I wouldn't want less of this cinematography. I did start thinking about this, though. I'm like, what if the movie was 90 minutes where Lockhart shows up and he just has a horrible day trying to get this guy out? And then it all kind of cascades to the whole ending.
But, like, if we had less time, though, to synthesize all these plot elements and stuff, I think that it just turns into a bonkers movie that was shot well instead of a fantastic movie that is ill understood.
And when you look at a lot of gothic classics. You know, there's what, Rebecca. I'm going to miss a lot, but there's Rebecca. There's, I'm not going to say Crimson Peak's a classic, but gothic horror does tend to take its time.
Yeah, or even the movie Gothic, which was about the night that Mary Shelley and Percy came up with their stories of Dracula and Frankenstein.
Yeah, and even I've read some short stories by what Flannery O'Connor, like A Good Man is Hard to Find, where they're short stories, but there's a very leisurely pace to them. So It would be unlike gothic horror if this thing was fast. If it was like the VHS 2 clip where the guy goes to the cult and everyone turns into monsters. Like that's like a 20 minute clip. This movie needs to have a methodical pace because that's what the genre requires. And I like that this movie was made. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love superheroes, sequels. I love all these kind of things. It's a reality right now. But this movie just felt so refreshing because it was 2.5 hours and it did take its time and it was beautifully shot. So would it have made more money if it was more condensed? Maybe. But would it have been so cool to look at? And, you know, no. So I think the 2.5 hours was justified.
And I think that the story was so crazy and so elaborate that if you had less time between learning more and more about it for it to simmer, I think that it would be even more confusing. It would seem more confounded. People wouldn't get it as much. I don't even think they'd like it as much. Yeah. I think that this needs to simmer with you. And I'm going to say again, 2.5 hours, yes. Were there 10 slow minutes? I don't think so. I don't. I was loving it the whole way.
Big fan.
Yeah. So this next question, this is another first-time questioner. So Cthulhu 502 is a first-time questioner. This comes from Gina from Fort Lauderdale. And Gina was in Africa with me while you guys were missing me and Mark was rolling on about a month or so ago. And Gina asks, so my movie buddy and I just finished A Cure for Wellness. We have so many questions, but there is one that is prominent in my mind that has taken over the conversation for the last 15 or 20 minutes. She was writing this to me, by the way, from Funky Buddha. She said, who is the genius that designed that weird obsession lab with a vent into the ballroom? Preservatives smell bad all the time, every time. Why would you want to vent into a fancy ballroom 24/7? And this brings us to an interesting point in the movie. And that is the point at which, after which Hannah has become a woman. She's had her coming of age moment and she walks into the pool and the eels are swimming through the blood. It's very weird. And then Volmer essentially marries her, has some weird cult thing with all of the members of the staff or a part of his Volmer longevity cult of incest.
They're all wearing white cloaks.
Right, white cloaks. And then he has his sexual assault in their nuptial bed and his, I like what Gina calls it, his obsession lab, like down there. And then, of course, Lockhart's down there trying to save her. It turns into a fight. A fire starts. All these chemicals are burning. And the fire and the chemicals and everything goes all the way up into this ballroom where people are still dancing at the wedding reception, essentially, the culty wedding reception. Like, if this movie was 90 minutes and you went to that scene, everyone would just be screaming bullshit. Like, I quit.
know, it's funny that I never thought about that. But do you think there's a certain amount of ego involved? You have the ballroom beneath where everything goes on, like kind of. I mean,
just convenient.
Yeah, it's a terrible idea, but I mean,
maybe it was just the only place structurally where he could easily do it. And it's almost like Bruce Wayne's Batcave. Like, you didn't design the Batcave. Those caves happened to be under your house. And then you just made it work. And maybe that was the most responsible way to vent it without creating a health liability under there in his obsession lab.
And the good thing is that ballroom they had was very windowed. They could open those up. There's a high ceiling where the air could go. You don't want it kind of shooting out into labs. You don't want it shooting out into the sauna or that weird tank room where everyone gets eels shoved into their mouths, which So they made a fake head and they put a tube down it, and those were really baby eels going into that fake head. But yeah, so that's pretty crazy. So I mean, I guess if you're gonna vent it somewhere, you want to have high ceilings and a lot of windows. It's still not practical, but I could see a twisted logic and like a weird, you know, they're dancing above where the thing is going on. So these crazies probably think that's normal.
So what'd you think, by the way, of the sets of his obsession? I love the term obsession lab, of his obsession lab, and how there's the bedroom down there, and there's almost like the shrine that he had to the images of his wife. And he has all those mutilated fetuses there that were all the miscarriages that his wife was having, presumably from the toxic water before he had honed the longevity of the mountain water with the eels. I don't know how on earth anyone ever got to that, by the way, but like, how did you feel about all that?
I was more into the practical sets that they use by going on location and cleaning. They cleaned out that building for 3 months to make it filmable to be in this place. I love the practical sets that they use. The set was cool. I liked his underground lair. But just seeing all the babies and the eels, like it felt very on the nose, and it felt like he had a evil madman lair, which I guess he would. And I like that the water, they were putting dead people into the water that they feed everyone. That gave some cool answers to me. But I was less taken with that set than I was with the rest of the other sets.
It's kind of funny because I happened to see the new King Arthur movie with Jude Law and Charlie Hunnam before I saw A Cure for Wellness. And I'm looking at this scene where you're down there in the evil guy's lair cave, right? Jude Law, Jason Isaacs in the respective movies. And both of them have this underground body of water that's kind of mystical in the sense of the interesting alchemical effects of the water and the relationship with the eels, and then he's dumping the bodies into it, versus Jude Law, who had those serpentine, mystics that demanded their pound of flesh, if you will. Those two scenes, and I guess both of them are going back to some classical, like mythological, I won't call them tropes, but themes. I liked where that took me, that reminded me of that. And then there are all these other moments in storytelling that have these things, these brave people going into caves to face the monster. And then you come out different.
Yeah,
but it was neat. I agree, though, that as far as the sets, this was not a beautiful part of the film. This was just an elaborate and a depiction of mania and whatnot. And then there was that fight down there, right? The fight with Jason when his face comes off.
So he has like a gooey face. He looks like Red Skull, but he's green gooey skull. But there's a scene where Dane DeHaan gets thrown on a staircase from about 20 feet.
Dead.
And if
a
not
stone
dead,
staircase.
And if not dead, done.
And I think that not just 20 feet. It was like 20 feet down and 20 feet across.
I mean, he'd be dead. But I do love the end when Hannah hits Vollmer in the head with that shovel.
That was such a My Bloody Valentine kind of thing.
But the CGI and the shot. What amazes me about this movie is you have some incredibly weird things, but they're shot beautifully. Like that scene where Hannah's laying in the tub with the eels, they shot that with a crane. They use like a techno crane to shoot that. So we have these weird stock things that are shot beautifully. It's really amazing how much work they put into these crazy shovel into a green gooey skull guy.
By the way, did that when they first showed the face that he had that was floating in the fluid? Remember when like Lockhart's looking almost from the underside? Did you not immediately think, oh my god, it's Nicolas Cage from Face Off? And then his face gets peeled off, and it's like when Castor Troy wakes up in the hospital with his face off.
I couldn't handle it. I'm like, this movie just added another level of weird. I was all in.
And it's all green. Why was it green underneath.
You know, I don't get shook very much by movies, but this movie kept shaking me. Like, normally I can sit through an entire movie and be like, yeah, I get it. This one I kept going, are you serious?
No, but in all honesty, though, the things that were making me shake were more the moral sensibility testing things. Again, like the father-daughter sexual assault nuptial scene, that masturbation scene, just kind of the unexpected shock. No, it's not like it was offensive or anything, but of the, again, elderly full frontal nudity. Things just happen. You're like, wait, what? Like,
I'm pretty sure when I watched this, I talk about it being hard R now, but I was pretty sure I thought it was PG-13. So when everything happened, when that scene at the end happens with Hannah, and it's in a long scene, I'm just like, wow. I didn't expect any of it.
And there is something in that bed, nuptial bed, that Jason Isaacs does that I will not say, but I'm just going to say, do not watch this with your mother, father, or children.
Yeah.
It's very uncomfortable, even though it's not really exploitative. It's just morally testing.
I'm like, did Jason Isaacs just do that?
Dude, Jason Isaacs, all the stuff he's been in, he saw that script.
Yeah.
And he said yes. You got to wonder. I'll bet that he or his agent said, okay, Gore, look, this is – we get what you're doing, but this one moment that we're not going to discuss in the pod, but this one moment – is a little much. We got to just take out that one thing. And I'll bet Gore just said no.
And he did it. And I was like, wow.
And it was, boy, if there was a moment that made me shudder more than any other moment, it was that. And then I saw it again right before we did our pod last week. And even knowing what was coming, I saw him do it, and I'm just like, oh, my God. Like, oh, shit, make this – someone kill this guy.
It's a long scene, too.
Yep. And you see a lot of, again, what is presented as a transitioning from preteen or early teen girl topless for quite a while. And she has a very convincing young look to her. So it was – that was – again, so they're giving you a good bit of nudity – but it doesn't feel like they're giving it to you for TNA. It feels like they're giving it to you because this is what the scene merits to understand the sickness or something like that. I can't even probably properly verbalize this.
I mean, there was some shock value.
There was shock value. But I mean, it kind of magnified the shock of Jason Isaacs' mania, of Vollmer's mania for me. But man, that was just – but like there's no time – where I'm like, oh yeah, that nice boobs. Like that never crossed my mind. I'm just like, whoa.
Yeah. That's a squirrely scene.
It was and Jason Isaacs, you agreed to it. I don't know if that means that you lost an argument with your agent and or Gore Verbinski, or if it means that you are an actor and you are gonna conquer this role, or both.
How often do scripts like this come around, though?
God, though, like never. Can you imagine that when the script was read? Because Jason Isaacs and Dane DeHaan don't see what Gore envisions. And even if Gore tells them about it, oh, it's going to be grand and this, that, and the other, and you've seen my other movies, they're still going to be like, yeah, this is going to be like your other movies? And it was, but it's like I could imagine reading this and just being like, I don't know. I feel like this is me doing the artistic movie to get some street cred.
Yeah. You know, the guy that wrote this, Justin Haith, he also wrote Lone Ranger, Red Sparrow, and Revolutionary Road, and they're all 2.5 hours.
Good Lord. And they're all heavy, plotty, well-written things.
Yeah. I mean,
not the Lone Ranger. I don't think the Lone Ranger was that well-written, but
it was beautifully filmed.
Beautiful, yes.
I mean, the set pieces are second to none. But you know what's interesting between Cure for Wellness, Red Sparrow, and Revolutionary Road? I mean, they're movies for adults. They're Red Sparrow's like in a like not like a like a I'm not talking like a triple X movie. I'm talking a Red Sparrow's a smart thriller.
Right.
The Revolutionary Road is about the suburban people yelling at each other. Cure for Wellness is a very adult driven gothic film lover movie. So it's this guy has a very, I mean, he also wrote Snitch with The Rock, which is probably The Rock's best performance and most subdued performance. It's a very, it's like a thriller for like parents and adults. It's not a rock movie. So this guy is a very interesting writer in that he writes very different films, but they all feel the same. So I think that's kind of cool. Sorry to drop that on you.
No, you're good, man. This is we're digging deep into The Cure.
Yeah, we're in the cave right now with the eels, the 300-year-old eels.
So speaking of eels, Twitter user at blank Petra, she goes by the moniker Doug's mom. she asks, the only question I had during the film was, why did the patients have to swallow the eels? Now, this actually makes me wonder, because so many of the patients at some point in the movie seem kind of brainwashed. I remember earlier in the film, it felt like they were trying to hide something along with the staff. But then later, you hear people say things like, we got to get out of here. It's like, well, why would you ever want to leave? And then Dane DeHaan, after he gets the treatment, if you will, in this, it looks like a bariatric chamber, but it's really just filled with water, I think, or something, or a dehydration chamber or something. And then he's feeding tubed this bin of scuzzy water with the baby eels, right? And the first time we see him after that, he's sitting on that bench with that beautiful view at the corner of the estate. And Hannah walks over and she's talking to him about getting out of here. And he looks at her with this glazed, like, smiley look with, why would you ever want to leave? So at some point, he's being mind-controlled, brainwashed, serumed, something. But we don't seem to really ever address that in the movie.
Never. That's never addressed. And I have no idea what those eels would do in him.
And it happens right after the eels happen.
Yeah. Those eels are just to create the sweaty eel juice, right? That people drop into their mouth.
Right. But, and so I would have assumed that you are just in that chamber until you die, thus the mummified look. But then later, there he is, right after that scene.
With new teeth.
And they gave him, so that's expensive.
Yeah.
They gave him like a $6,000 tooth job, probably.
Yep. And do you have to find kind of bone grafts and everything? So he must have been out of commission for a while.
I mean, but he's brainwashed.
Yeah,
he is. And he isn't just like subdued or lobotomized, like, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He has straight up drank the Kool-Aid and is saying what they want him to say, just like people were earlier, and how people were hiding things. And when Pembroke disappears and he's looking to someone, they just close the door quietly like they're hiding away. And so there was some, that was maybe the, if I had an inconsistency that I would like explored or explained in the film, for me, this is it, because was that why he swallowed the eels, or was swallowing the eels just something that elicited a certain physiological reaction in the body that resulted in these secretions in the bariatric chamber? Like, what? I don't know.
And he wasn't faking it, because when Hannah handed him the little ballerina that his mom gave him, he kicked back into it. Like, he got back in the world. Maybe it's a traumatic experience. Maybe you just kind of recoil into a shell.
But again, he's saying what everyone says.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
and he's saying it with a smile. He seemed sincerely happy, even though that was unnaturally happy for his character.
So if some teeth were replaced, how long does it take to replace teeth?
I don't know. But in the movie, he was saying tomorrow morning, yada, 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 yada. And then she says, OK, I'm ready to go. It was overnight.
Now, they move fast on these teeth.
This whole movie took place over the span of like 3 or 4 days.
That's some fast teeth work.
I'm telling you. it would have probably taken that. Don't they have to mold or carve or shave down out of whatever material they use for those teeth? Like, they probably have to, if they're made out of porcelain or ceramic or something, like, you have to make that. Yep. So you probably have to take a mold of his teeth. Then you have to create a mirror image of the tooth in question, because you got rid of the original tooth, and then you got to drill in a root or something
and implant. And a bone, the bone up there. So, I mean,
that's got to heal. Like, and it's like, he doesn't even know any of this stuff happened.
Yeah.
So I guess my answer to, did they really, why did the patients have to swallow the eels? I don't fucking know.
I feel like that should have been a last stop shop. Like there's a scene where he sees eels going into somebody, and that's where the secretions come out and the people die.
Right, but right, and that's what I wanted to assume. In fact, after I saw the movie the first time, that's what I thought. But now watching it the second time, I caught that it was the next day after the treatment, and it's like, wait a minute, that isn't the end of the line. Because I thought, because you looked over, remember he looked over and he saw Pembroke, and he looked a little more sunken or whatever, and sick. And so I thought that's where you go to finish out. And by the way, while we're on the topic of dying in this movie, remember when he thinks that he saw Pembroke dead floating in the water in that room where everyone was floating in the water?
Yeah.
And presumably now, I guess that was how when Vollmer was explaining how we all started in water and were this much water, maybe that was some like almost amniotic fluid. Like they used in what was the movie? In the movie The Abyss. Instead of breathing air in the tank, you would inhale this water that was like amniotic water, oxygenated water. Maybe that's what it was, and they were sleeping in there, because then we see Pembroke later, and I'm like, did they clone him? Did Vollmer make a Pembroke face? It's like, no, he's really alive, because then yet after that he died.
And was mummified.
But that's much easier for me to rationalize than the eels and the brainwashing.
I liked your idea of it.
What'd you say? Brainwashing?
No, the I don't effing know.
It's like, I don't fucking know. That's true. So at Blank Petra from Twitter, you have just illustrated more questions that I have with your question. And for anyone who forgot, in the mania of discussion, the question was, why did the patients have to swallow the eels? Or more precisely, why did Vollmer and his staff, basically feeding tube those eels into someone? And by the way, you're feeding tubing that into someone's stomach who's alive. Homeostasis exists. It does not take the body very long to turn that water into body temperature. Those eels are going to die.
Yep.
So something's also, that was maybe an unreasonable amount of fluid to pump in. Like that looked like a few gallons. Like, can we just address, like, that looked like a few gallons. I don't know where that was all going, but that was probably more for the dramatic effect.
Yeah. Just look, you need all that water to shove all those eels down.
Even if it was just 1 gallon, let's say it's 1 gallon and I'm not remembering it right. It was the aspect ratio that made it look so big to me. I don't know. But even if it was just 1 gallon, that is a tremendous amount of fluid. I guess whatever. I mean, they aren't eating a whole lot and it'll fit uncomfortably. But I mean, you drink 1 gallon of water, you're probably going to have to pee in 20 minutes. Those eels are going to lose some space in there. They're going to cook in your body temperature.
Maybe that's what the bariatric chambers were for.
We're not cook. You're going to poach them in your body heat.
Oh, goodness.
You poached eels.
Wait, so maybe – so the eels are just to create the juice, and maybe later on they brainwash you.
But again, they never touched the brainwashing. Clearly something like that happened, though. Clearly.
I don't think they could have done the teeth that fast.
I think – do we have any dentist listeners? Please write it. We want to know.
Well, no, my mother-in-law is going through the process right now, and so she had like a bone graft that didn't take. I mean, it's been a process.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just overly conscious of bone.
We're bringing in some deep reaching questions. I've got another question. This one comes from Fiendish Dr. Wu. That's at Jim Jones Cool A2 on Twitter. And this listener asks, I found it reminiscent of Cronenberg and have no real gripes with it, as I've heard nothing about it beforehand and watched it more on impulse than anything else. So had no real expectations, and I found it to be a pleasant surprise. I love that he mentions Cronenberg, because this brings me back to all of the seemingly exploitative components in this film, which did not actually feel exploitative in presentation. They just felt like this raw, morally visceral rather than gratuitous. Like a lot of these scenes felt like that. I think of movies like The Brood, which has this weird external amniotic birth scene that's very uncomfortable, and the weird nudity in the movie, and movies like Rabid, which also take a similar effect in The Fly, but of course that's its own universe.
And then there's what, Videodrome and Existence and Scanners. I mean, Existence had like alternate realities, weird, really.
Yeah, like reaching into the stomach and stuff. And I gotta agree, there are aspects of this that were very Cronenberg-esque. I was kind of wondering as I was watching it what this made me feel like, and a Cronenbergian approach, albeit with a much more beautifully architected film. That just hit the nail on the head for me.
Yeah, I guess there's body horror in this, but I guess when I associate sometimes with Cronenberg, I associate pretty extreme body horror.
Right. Well, in this one, it was just the sense of bodily invasion, which actually happens in the movie Shivers.
Yeah.
Where people have that kind of, it actually like a blood fluke, as it turns out, as discussed earlier, that gets into your bloodstream and it turns you into a kind of 28 Days Later rage zombie.
And I guess Videodrome has the paranoia aspect of it. What am I seeing? What have you seen? Oh, this tape is nothing. You didn't see that. You know, people getting messed with. James Woods. Also, Cronenberg did a Dangerous Method with with Keira Knightley, Fassbender, and Viggo Mortensen, and that pacing of that was very deliberate. And so this movie had some very deliberate pacing as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's basically a Cronenbergian-esque vision through Gore Verbinski's brain. I see it.
Yeah. Yep. I certainly do. Again, that was nail on the head, spot on.
I love some good Cronenberg body horror. or is his A History of Violence, Eastern Promises?
Didn't he do Crash?
Yeah, Crash. I mean, talk about body horror. I mean, there's some gruesome images in that.
Yeah.
Not the Oscar-winning movie. We're talking about the one in the '90s where people have sex while they crash their cars.
Yeah, it was weird. Oh, yeah, that's right. People are probably thinking of like Sandy Bullock and like Michael Pena when I say that. No. Nope.
James Spader running around. So we're all set on questions?
Oh, yeah. Five good ones. One comment. I call them mailbags, by the way, people. So just when we ask you for questions, you know, feel free to just write us some cool comments. Even if you give us some cool comments like Fiendish Dr. Wu did. I'd love to share them and use them to share ideas here.
I got to tell you something, John.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm on location, I am riding a bicycle down that mountain, and I'm going to look as happy as Dane DeHaan did.
So that's so crazy. So when the movie ends, right, Dane DeHaan has, with Hannah's help and a shovel, defeated Vollmer, and then they push him into his water that has given him an unnaturally long Dracula-like life, right? And then they're just leaving. The place is on fire, remember, from the wedding reception because it went up the vents and all that. And they get on the bike, the same bike they used to go into town before, into the Frankenstein village. And yeah, they're, like you said, they're riding down that hill on this bicycle. And Dane DeHaan, after he basically turns down a ride to the airport, he from the board, right? Because they're just showing up at this dramatic time. But of all the things, by the way, that happened that are bonkers task in this movie, that might have been the most unrealistic moment.
Yeah, they show up at the exact time, and you're like, oh, right, brother.
As he's leaving, they could have come a minute later, and they would have been gone. But so they just keep going, right? And they're riding the bicycle, and he puts on this smile that is nothing short of villainous. And both times I've seen the movie, I ask myself, what did I miss? Why is he villainous? It is sinister.
This is going to sound weird, but I didn't get a sinister vibe from it. I just got a momentarily maniacal. Like, he knew if he went back with these people, they would throw him under the bus. He's hanging out with some 300-year-old girl who just went through probably the most traumatic thing that's ever going to happen to, could ever happen to a human being. And he's riding down a hill on a sweet bike. Like, he has every reason to be momentarily maniacal.
I don't know. I when I saw that, I thought he was more evil than Bulmer.
Really?
Both times. That's why I said, both times when I saw the end of the movie, I was asking myself what I missed. It was, even though when I think back rationally, I can't put anything together, but it's like, I was even thinking to myself the first time I saw it, when I was just overtaken by the craziness, I was like, is that Vollmer? No, I saw Vollmer get killed with a shovel to the head. But like, I mean, I was almost questioning if it was Vollmer. It was, it looked so evil to me both times. And they show the shine in his eyes, and that's the biggest smile that he has in the entire film, and it looked evil, and the music was dramatic.
Is he finally free?
That didn't look like a happy smile to me. That looked like an Evil Dead. I'll swallow your soul. I'll swallow your soul. Like he, I mean, it looked sinister. It looked Luciferian.
That's funny. You were thinking about him looking maniacal, and I was thinking about how awesome it would be to ride a bike down there at that scene.
You were having a Stranger Things moment, and I was having a Prophecy moment.
I'm going to ride a bicycle down that hill.
So would you, knowing what you know about this place, right? I mean, it looks beautiful, though. I kind of like, I feel like I could fall into the trap of saying, look, I know this place is evil. I'm just not going to drink their water. I'm going to bring a case of Diet Coke and some bottled water. And if I don't hear it snap, I'm not drinking it. So I'm going to bring my own bottle of water and some Diet Coke, maybe some whiskey. I'm going to spend a day there because it's beautiful and everyone's very polite. And I'm going to enjoy the most beautiful view of the Swiss Alps that you can find because I'm looking through Gore Verbinski's eyes. Like, wouldn't you like to go there?
Yeah, I would make sure I was with friends. I would bring two friends. We would each have a backpack. If we're there for, let's say we're there for a day, enough water that we see the entire time. Whiskey and some
– right, you keep the water with you. That's
and,
right.
And like a couple cans of LaCroix and Coke so you know they can't be tampered with. Mm-hmm. There is a scene in that movie where Dane DeHaan walks up to Hannah and she's walking by this reflecting pool and the mountains are in the background.
God, it's
and,
gorgeous.
Yeah, Megan just went, oh, shut up. Like this.
You know what's funny? I was about to also say that that felt like the most gratuitously pretty thing that I saw.
We were just like, holy crap. Like, this is a beautiful, beautiful shot. So, yeah, man, I'd risk it.
So this actually makes me think, because now we're talking about bringing your own water, this, that, and the other, right? So Dane DeHaan, Lockhart, I always do that. So Lockhart, when he starts to notice that things are looking funny, it's after he saw what he perceived as some kind of a worm and what I'm calling a mosquito larva in his water glass. And you know that he's looking at that like, what is that? But at some point he had to probably like, did I drink some of that? And then later in the movie, people keep saying, make sure to drink plenty of water, the water, the water, the water. And he is so critical and talking about all the things that they're doing there. Like, that would have been such a weird moment, though, that the water had a viewable, a visible living thing in it. And all this weird stuff is going on. Like, maybe he should have noticed and like knocked down the water glass sooner in the movie.
I totally agree with you. But can I tell you something, John?
You can tell me anything, Mark.
I drink a lot of water. I love water. I like to stay hydrated. So it would be really –
I no longer trust you.
It would be really tough for me to not drink any water when I was there. I think I go crazy not drinking water.
What do you think was going on, by the way? We were talking about water, and then there was the toilet that always had the thing going. Remember how there were a couple scenes where he had visions of eels in the toilets?
He was just seeing things. There's no way those many eels could fit into that toilet.
Why on earth was that happening? That's another thing where I just sit back. It's like, and again, he was seeing the eels before he sees eels in the movie.
Yeah. I just, oh man, just looked great.
It was. It was creepy as hell too. Very creepy.
Like, it's weird when I'm looking at something really well shot that I just don't care about plot holes. I don't know.
This is one of those things that I didn't even think about until after I watched it.
Because this movie's also supposed to be purposely misleading at times, or purposely mess with your head. So I just kind of took that in stride.
It's interesting that a lot of movies that do that, though, that will, for example, like in this, they give you visions of something that the character hasn't seen yet. So there's no reason for him to have those visions. Not that, but again, that's also kind of like a filmmaking device, if you will. It's not supposed to be literal that he's seeing that per se, I guess, even if the character says eels are in the tank. But it's like when most movies do that, I don't like it. When this movie did it, like, I was all right with it. Instead, I just find myself, you know, bringing to question for the sake of a discussion. A lot of movies, when they pull stuff like that, I call it pulling a fast one.
Yeah, no, I just think this was so artfully done that you're like, I don't care.
And it was tactful.
Yeah.
What they did as well, the way that they staged the buildup for these things. It was very tactful, very methodical.
I mean, Gordon.
A most dangerous method, one might say.
I just think he's a king of set pieces, Gore Verbinski. I think he knows how to shoot a scene. And, I mean, you look at the Pirates movies, the Ring, Weatherman, where Nicolas Cage punches the dude out. Like, the guy just knows how to shoot certain scenes. He can make things work. So, yeah, you're right, though. I don't like false scare sometimes, but he also didn't really know what was going on in his head, so it worked for me.
Yeah, I mean, it was so – it just went with the – again, just the mania of this crazily – smart film.
I mean,
such a weird story.
At the end of the day, would you recommend it?
Oh yeah, if I had more time in a day, I would have watched this more times in the last week, just leading up to chatting about it.
Would you recommend it to a casual viewer?
I don't know about that. I think that this is really for someone who considers themselves an ambitious or adventurous film goer. People who like to find things that people haven't heard of, even though this was a big release. Like, I think that you need to have an appreciation for the weird.
Yeah, I agree. As much as I hate to say it, this is not a movie that was made for the mainstream.
And not for the morally delicate, because again, there's a lot of stuff in this movie where people's personal reaction may take them out of the film.
Yeah, this is a movie where you like recommend, guys, everybody has to see Cure for Wellness, and people actually trust you, and then they watch it, and you're like, man, Mark, you're smoking.
Dude, they would be, if I told a room of people that, and they all listened, my house would become Castle Frankenstein, and people would become with torches at night, and pitchforks.
But like we said, it's an adventurous film, it's a beautiful looking film. If you're a fan of film, absolutely watch it.
And this was ambitious from a filmmaking perspective, and it was really cavalierly ambitious from a storytelling perspective, because this was like – people come up with movie plots, right, and stories, and they have how it should be in their head, or you have the intensity of the book, if you will, right? Not that this is based on a book. But then you're like, okay, what is the film adaptation of that? I think this scene is a little too much for general audiences, even though we rated it R. You know, this stuff happens. If I feel like no punches were pulled this.
I think they just gave him $40 million and said, do what you want.
Do what you want, yeah. And this is one of the cases where I love that happened.
Yeah, I don't know how much more it's going to happen, but I love that it did.
God, so. such a weird movie. It feels like it should be older.
Yeah, I mean, this is a throwback. This could fit like in the 70s, like Rosemary's Baby type stuff.
Yeah. I'm very wowed by it, though. Like, if anyone – I don't know why anyone would still be listening if they haven't seen this movie, unless they were certain in their head that they didn't want to see it and just wanted to hear us chat about it. But it's like at this point, if you stuck with us this long and weren't disgusted by the things I said, you probably want to see this movie.
Yeah.
Such a weird movie. I have difficulty comparing this to other stuff. The social thriller aspect – I'm saying that because of the movie Get Out, by the way. But it's like the social thriller aspects of this made me think of a period piece version of Get Out at times, even though this wasn't a period piece.
I mean, it does have a message, right, about how
Oh, it's all about social manipulation.
Yeah.
You're just breaking these people out. You keep telling them that something's wrong with them while telling them that you're making them better and cultivating the sense that they need this. You are psychologically getting them to addict themselves to what you are selling.
Ooh. All right. So let's end on that note. You got some plugs?
I got to thank our wonderful listeners. This was pretty cool because more than half of our questions and mailbag submissions were from first-time submitters.
Woo.
So thanks to the Fear Merchant on Twitter. Fear Merchant has The Bazaar, their Fearcast, their podcast that you can find that through thefearmerchant.com. There's at Cthulhu502 on Twitter. We're not really familiar yet, but I hope that you keep commenting and we keep chatting because I enjoyed your question. Gina from Fort Lauderdale, again, first timer. She was in Africa with me. She's really into movies. I had a lot of fun chatting with her in Africa, and I'm glad that now she's a friend of the pod too, and not just a friend of mine. And at Blank Petra from Twitter, great question that aroused more question about eel swallowing and brainwashing. And at Jim Jones Cool A2, which is Fiendish Dr. Wu on Twitter. And Fiendish has taken part in a lot of online conversations with us. I think this might only be the second or third time they've submitted with us. So, again, that's all wonderful. And I was really, really hoping for Johnny Numb. I thought that he was going to get us a question, but he hadn't seen the movie yet. And I think that he's probably watching the movie last night or tonight as we record. So I have a feeling that when we do our next episode, we might have a Cure for Wellness question from Johnny. And he's been a great friend of the pod. He's with Crash Palace, The Last Knock podcast, and Loud Green Bird. So all those folks, thanks for sharing and thanks for being a part. And Mark, what do you have for us, my friend?
Head to www.moviesfilmsandflix.com. That's moviesfilmsandflix.com. Head to iTunes, rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. We'd love to know what you think. Give us a rating on iTunes. Also, send us in any questions on Twitter, on Facebook, on our site. If you go to our site, you'll see the links for all of our Twitter and Facebook. And we love hearing from you. No question is too dumb. And once again, guys, we appreciate every single one of you who listen to us. We know that there's a lot of podcasts out there. We know that free time is limited. So thank you very, 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 very much for listening, and have a great night. So for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and John, don't let Roger Moore eat barbecue ribs. Levin good. This is Movies, Films, and Flicks. We'll see you next week when we cover The Babysitter.
Boom.
Bye.